So let's ask the Lord to guide my words so that they will give glory to him and hopefully help you to understand some of these bits and pieces. Where had we got to last time? Let's have a look. The conclusions we reached last time is hopefully that all of us can agree that the things we observe in the universe need explaining. That's why we do science in the first place. If we didn't think that the things around us needed explanations, causes, reasons, we wouldn't bother to do science. But we do, and it works. So that must basically be true. And as I said rather cheekily, once you've agreed that, then it's basically all over for the atheists. What do I mean? Okay. If a thing needs explaining, and it exists, then logically we must say that the explanation exists as well. And if the explanation also needs to be explained, then you've got to look further back for another explanation again, and so on and so on. And ultimately we need to get back to an ultimate cause, a first cause, an uncaused cause. So you can explain me in terms of my parents, but to explain them, you need my grandparents, and so on and so on, and how far are you going to go? And even if you carry on all the way to infinity, then if all of those things that you're looking in, an infinite chain of causes, if they're all contingent, if they're all like me and my parents and my grandparents and my great-grandparents, it doesn't matter how far back you go, even if you go back forever and ever and ever, the whole collection of those people still need explaining. Just because there are infinitely many of them doesn't mean that therefore they're magically explained by themselves. We remember the chickens and the eggs that we saw last time. Okay. We then moved on and thought about the way we do science, and in particular doing science of the whole universe. When we do science of the whole universe, cosmology, not just the science of things in the universe, but the science of the universe as a whole, just by trying to do that, we admit that the whole universe needs to be caused. And when cosmology works, that just confirms for us that the universe needs a cause. There's something higher, above, beneath, before, whatever word you want to use. Our human words fail, but somehow or other, a cause, a reason, an explanation for the whole universe. So we recognize that the universe itself cannot be the ultimate cause of everything or the first cause of everything, because we know that we can and need to explain it. So either the first ultimate cause must be God, or we saw the only other plausible candidate for that was the laws of science. And because we saw that all the laws of science link up one to another, we haven't quite got to that final formulation when we can sum up all of the laws of physics in one law. We've got it down to two, and scientists are struggling to find the one, but we have every confidence that somewhere deep down that one law is there. So either that one law, the ultimate law of the universe, is the cause of everything, the simple unity principle explanation behind everything we see, or it's God. And we actually saw that when you look at the characteristics of a one scientific law that must be non-material, acting throughout time, in other words, eternal, must be the same in every place, so omnipresent, causes everything that happens in the universe, brings the whole universe into existence, and is probably just one, it starts to look very like God. But we were left with a real question that's an important one, and it's the one that really I want to look at today, which is, is that first cause of the universe really what we think of as God? And in particular, is it personal? Is that first cause of the universe something, someone that knows and understands and loves and wills things? Or is it just an impersonal force? That's really what I want to ponder today and invite you to ponder that along with me. So one of the ways that we can see that God might be personal, if we can see there's evidence that the universe is designed. Because if the universe is not just meaningless, but is carefully designed for a purpose, then whatever brings the universe into existence needs to be a designer. In other words, something with a mind, something with a purpose. And when we're going to talk about this first cause being personal, I don't mean a human being, I don't mean a supercomputer, I don't mean a mind in the way that we experience the minds of one another. But I mean something that in some way, analogous to the way that we think, it can think and know, in analogously to the way that we choose things and desire them and bring them into existence, it can know and will and bring things into existence. So we're not trying to think of just like a human being, but brainier. We're thinking radically different, but with that in common with us, that it can know and love and choose. One of the ways that it might be possible to argue for a designer, and we looked at this a couple of weeks ago, was to look at the design of living things. Do you remember William Paley we looked at? He had a design argument, and we saw that that design argument failed. So let's remind ourselves how to get it wrong. So he said, supposing you're walking over a heath and you find a stone, well, for all you know, it may always have been there. But if you walk over the same heath and you find a watch, you're not just going to go, oh, well, maybe that's always been there. The intricacy of its workings and its complexity and the way that it serves a function tells you that it's been designed. And then if on the same heath you find a jaguar, well, then you're in trouble. But other than that, you see how much more complex it is, how much more intricately it is structured, and how those parts of that structure work together for a common purpose. And so Paley argues that there must therefore have been a designer of living things as well. And well, that's God. Because it's certainly not a human being that's designed living things. We are living things. We kind of designed ourselves. But we saw this argument goes wrong because it's a God of the gaps argument. Implicitly, it presumes that there can be no natural cause of living things, that science can't explain life, therefore it must have been God. And as we saw, arguably Darwin and other scientists have filled that gap. So the argument that William Paley put forward fails because it's actually a badly structured argument. It makes the assumption that nothing can explain how species of life arose, and in fact, maybe something can apart from God. So what I want to do today is to take a bit of time looking at Darwin's theory and the way that it has developed in the 150 years since Darwin put it forwards, and to evaluate his arguments from a scientific point of view and from a theological point of view. And then I'd like to move on and to look at a better design argument than William Paley's. And when we've done that, we'll be at final conclusions. Okay. Let's just start off with the origin of life briefly. This isn't something that Darwin talks about. Darwin talks about how life develops, evolves, once life has got started. So this is going back a little bit earlier than what Darwin was considering. Come on to that in a second. We saw last time, when we looked at the history of the Big Bang and how the universe has developed from that, that with second-generation stars, so once the first lot of stars have produced chemical elements, exploded, and then gravity has pulled those chemical elements together, you can get rocky planets with interesting chemicals on them. Those can develop from simple chemicals to complex chemicals, particularly complex carbon-based chemicals, in other words, organic chemicals. And these two people, Miller and Urey, in 1952, did an extremely crude experiment to see how complex organic chemicals might arrive. What they wanted to do is try and simulate the conditions on the early Earth in the atmosphere. So they got a big jar and put in it methane and ammonia and water and zapped it with electricity to simulate lightning and cooked it for quite a long time, I think a few months. And what they got out was a brown sludge. But in that brown sludge were amino acids, the basic building blocks of proteins, which are the basic building blocks of life. They found about 20 amino acids in that dark brown sludge that go to make you and me. Now, they did not create life, but they created, in an extraordinarily crude experiment, chemicals that are significant for life. Therefore, it doesn't seem unreasonable to suppose that with not just a few months of cooking a few chemicals together and zapping it with electricity, but with maybe 500 million years or so on the early Earth, and quite possibly on lots of other planets as well, that somehow or other life began by natural processes. We don't know how. We can begin to get hunches about how that might happen. The latest theory is it may well have happened at what are called hydrothermal vents in the sea. That's areas where lava is basically getting very close to the sea floor and it heats up the water, and the water under the sea starts to boil. And if you've got that sort of warmth and various organic chemicals, then it may well be that's where life started. In those sorts of hydrothermal vents that still exist on Earth now, life is enormously rich, including forms of life that don't depend on oxygen. And that's crucial because it's actually life itself that's produced oxygen on Earth. So you need to know that you could get life that doesn't depend on oxygen, but we find that around hydrothermal vents. However life happened, we need to be careful of a God of the gaps argument that says, we don't know how life started, therefore it must have been God. That's just a shoddy argument. It's bad logic. So let's not say that. Actually, by the way, it's only relatively recently that we've had the theory that life can only start from other living things. If you go back, let's say, to the time of Aristotle, he was of the opinion that, for instance, living things could emerge spontaneously from non-living. So fleas could emerge from dust, or maggots could emerge on rotting meat. It was actually only in the mid-19th century that that theory was finally disproved. So the idea that, oh, well, of course you can't just get life emerging from something that's non-living, is a 20th and 21st century prejudice. Anyway, let us suppose, at least as a possibility, that life can begin by natural processes. I'm not saying it absolutely did, and I can prove that, but I'm saying we better not argue that it's absolutely impossible and couldn't have done, and therefore you need God to fill that gap. Let's look at what Darwin said. Well, actually, it's not just Darwin. Darwin published his theory of the origin of species in 1859, but like every scientific theory, that's been added to and developed. So about 50 years afterwards, Mendel developed his theory of genetics, and that enormously enhanced Darwin's theory. And then biochemistry came along, and for instance, the structure of the DNA molecule was worked out by Crick and Watson, famously, about 50 years ago, a little bit more than that. But that DNA molecule is the basis of reproduction, so the fundamental basis of life. I guess you're familiar with its double helix shape, and you might be familiar that if you unzip or untwist that double helix, it sort of looks a little bit like this. So the double helix ends up as two strands going across here, and there are various sort of chemical lumps that are attached to it in a sequence rather like a ladder. They go by the name of bases, and they're always, there are only four possible ones: adenine abbreviated to A, cytosine abbreviated with C, guanine symbolized by G, and thymine symbolized by T. And the two strands that you get in the DNA molecule that twisted into that double helix, they always match up in corresponding pairs. So A always goes with T, C always goes with G. That's the way it fits together because of the shape of those molecules and the way that they bond together. It has to be those two pairs. And they continue for obviously miles and miles and miles. I've only given you a tiny portion. What happens when a cell divides? That as well as a cell dividing to reproduce, this double helix splits open, it sort of unzips, and where it has unzipped, you can start building another copy of the other part of the zip. So for instance, here, the C always has to match a G, the T has to match an A, the G has to match a C, and the next G that's just about to be added on will obviously have to be another C. And you can see that's exactly what was on the other half of the zip. So what you're getting is an exact copy of what was there, and the thing is replicating into two strands of DNA. And obviously the same thing happens in the other direction. And as that unzips all the way along, you end up with two essentially perfect copies of the genetic information. And that's fundamentally the way that reproduction happens, so that the DNA, which is controlling the information that builds our proteins, which is what our bodies are made of, can be very, very accurately reproduced time after time. It's extraordinarily accurate, but not absolutely perfect. Sometimes it goes a bit wrong. For whatever reason, there can be all sorts of reasons why that process might just occasionally go wrong. But if it does, that's what's called a mutation. And if a mutation happens, then a cell that inherits that mutation will have a slightly different genetic code. Many mutations don't cause any significant difference at all for the cell, in which case the mutation just sort of carries on or will then be reproduced time after time as those cells divide again and again and again. Lots of mutations are harmful, in which case the cell is most likely to die. But just occasionally, a mutation might enhance how a cell functions. And if it does, then that cell will be likely to do a little bit better than others around it, and the organism that contains it will do a little bit better than other organisms of the same species. Organisms that inherit defective mutations are going to die, and so slowly, 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 the mutations that are favourable will accumulate, and the mutations which are unfavourable will die out. And on the whole, you expect beneficial mutations to build up. That's basically the essence of Darwin's theory of natural selection, that there are variations, only if, you know, relatively slowly, but there are variations in genetic material, and the favourable ones, those that are naturally selected, that make an organism more successful in feeding and reproduction and what have you, will build up, and those that are unfavourable will die out, purely naturally. And if you have those sorts of things going on, let's say, in different environments, then what's selected, let's say, in a cold environment might be what's selected for in a dry, in a hot environment, what's selected in a watery environment will be different from what's selected in a dry environment, and so forth. So in different places, different sorts of features can be selected and enhanced. So again, over vast amounts of time, we can expect that what started off as one species will diverge into two or more in different environments. That's roughly speaking, in a nutshell, what Darwin's theory says. Okay, let's make some comments. First of all, what I've suggested to you is an extraordinarily simplified version of what Darwin came up with, and certainly much simpler than our current understanding of how evolution works. If you want to know more details, read a good science textbook. By the way, please don't read the literature of people who have an axe to grind about evolution, just as you wouldn't read anything about anything with someone with an axe to grind. Go to someone who really believes that it works to find out the science. By all means, read the critics as well to make up your own mind, but don't rely on the people who are negative to give you all the truth. One of the things that is often said is that evolution is just a theory of chance or randomness. But this is something that it's not. And even our favourite atheist, Richard Dawkins, is at pains to point this out. He said in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, "One of my tasks will be to destroy this eagerly believed myth that Darwinism is a theory of chance." It's not. It's a theory of natural selection. What causes mutations at some level is chance, is random. But which mutations are selected is not random. That's determined by what works well in a cell, what works well for an organism in an environment. That's not random. That's ordered. And what governs the path of evolution is not the random mutations, but which ones are selected. So it's not a theory of randomness. And anyway, the causes of mutations are not ultimately random. We can identify various possible scientifically controlled causes of mutations. We call them random because in the end, we don't need to know what they are in order to understand evolution. If it was caused by angels rolling dice, evolution would still work the same way. It's not caused by angels rolling dice, as you well know. But even if it were, it's probably caused by various chemical imbalances or by cosmic rays or who knows what else. So it's not a theory of randomness. It's a theory of order. And there are many difficulties for this theory to overcome. For instance, is there enough time for all the evolution that we see in the world to have happened? Interesting question. Proteins are very complex things. So just making odd mutations here and there in the DNA, which is what synthesizes proteins, may not be quite as straightforward as we'd like to think it is. So there can be problems that this theory needs to accept to deal with scientifically. That's okay. We expect scientific theories to start off partial and to grow and develop. That's what happens with any scientific theory. We looked at last week at the idea of Newton's theories of motion being developed by Einstein. It's perfectly normal that a theory starts off, explains some things, and then hits a problem, and then someone else comes along and says, ah, we can do better, and enhance it. Okay, let's evaluate the scientific status of the theory of evolution. Is the logic sound? Yes, I think it is. I think the logic of natural selection works. Whether that's exactly what's governing the evolution of life is a question for scientists to answer, but the logic is sound. Have we observed natural selection? Yes, we have. For instance, we're all familiar with the antibiotic-resistant bugs in hospital that develop because they're living in a hostile environment. When they're living in an environment with lots of antibiotics, those that, for whatever reason, develop a certain resistance do better and do well. And hospital environments are great environments for those sorts of bugs to evolve. We see it. Has life actually evolved on Earth? Yes. At least in this sense, that through the course of history, we see different species of life, and we can see, as it were, lines of traceable lineages. So we see early fossils of fish, and then amphibians emerge, and then reptiles emerge, and those evolve into dinosaurs, which evolve into birds. we can see those lines going on in different aged rocks. And you don't, for instance, find fossils of human beings in the oldest rocks. We can see different sorts of species at different times. So at that level, undoubtedly, there has been a variation of the sorts of life there are over the about 4 billion years that life has existed on Earth. So what's the evidence in favour of evolution? First of all, I think just the fossil record, it's a powerful witness to the fact that different species of life have existed at different times. Then things like vestigial structures. Why is it, for example, that some whales and some snakes have pelvic bones, and even some snakes, even pythons, have tiny little residual stubs as sort of, as it were, hind legs? Why have they got those? If snakes have evolved from lizards, if whales have evolved from other mammals, then it's easy to understand why there might be the remnants of what used to be legs or what used to be hips in the skeletons of those animals. If they didn't evolve from other species, if they're directly created by God, what was God thinking? Did he just put them there to test us and catch us out? I don't think so. Or why do flightless birds have wings? What's that all about? We can even talk about what we might call design faults. Let me give you an example from your eyes. You probably know that your eyes have a blind spot. That's because the nerves, which are the wiring of your eyes, the nerves are on the inside of your eyes, and they're covering the light-sensitive part of your eye, the retina. The nerves are in front of that. And in order to get out of your eye to your brain, there has to be a hole through the back of your eye that those nerves can get through. And where that hole goes through, you've got a blind spot. And if anybody designed a camera like that, with the wiring on the inside and then a hole through the light-sensitive part to get the wires out, you'd say 5 out of 10, at the very most, for pretty bad design. But that's the way our eyes are. If you look at an octopus eye, it's the other way round. The wiring of an octopus eye is on the outside. Octopuses don't have blind spots. So why do we? If we've evolved, we can understand why that might have happened. If it's just direct creation by God, he doesn't get very many marks for being an engineer. And then finally, the shared biochemistry. All living things have basically the same biochemical basis. We share about 98% of our genes with chimpanzees. We share about 33% of our genes with bananas. Which third of me is banana? All of me. Okay, I know. Good joke, Rack. Why is it that there's such a common basis? Anywhere else where we see patterns looking similar in the world, science wants to say, what's the common origin? Why are these things so similar? Why do we not want to do that? Why shouldn't we do that with living things? I think we should. Let me give you an example from another field. You probably know I teach at the seminary, and so every now and again I have to mark students' essays. Now, if I see, I don't often very well, but just if on occasion I see a passage in one essay that is extremely similar to a passage in another essay, okay, you've laughed, you know what I'm going to say. You've worked it out already. Maybe the two students just completely independently wrote exactly the same words, but that's not very likely. Chances are one of them copied the other, or they both downloaded something off the internet. Okay, so if we've got genetic material that's similar to one another, really it looks like it's been copied. There's copying going on. Could God have created all these species of life independently? Yes, of course he could. Would he have done that? I think that's less likely. He could have done it, but it's like creating the dinosaur bones just to test us. That dinosaurs didn't really exist, but he's created all those fossils just to see if we'll believe what he wrote in the Bible or whether we'll go down the wrong road of science. That's not a God of truth. That's not a God of honesty and love and care for the human race. That's a God who's deceitful. And I don't believe in a God who's deceitful. I don't think he's put tricks in there just to catch us out. Does Darwinism or neo-Darwinism account for all the observed species of life and all the facts of evolution that we observe? Answer, probably for most of it. No scientific theory, we've already said a minute ago, is immune from being developed or even replaced. And there's no reason why we should suppose that Darwin's theory is any different from any other. So we expect it to be modified. We expect refinements. And in fact, we've had that. We've seen that, you know, genetics and biochemistry have enormously enhanced Darwin's original theory. We know that those sorts of mutations I was talking about a minute ago are not the only thing that causes evolution. One of the things that goes on, for example, is things like viruses transfer whole chunks of genetic material from one organism to another, or even from one species to another. So it's not just individual little bases on the DNA molecule that change one by one. Sometimes whole chunks of genes can just be cut out and plonked into another organism. And there are probably many other mechanisms that can help evolution work. So it's not that we need to say, Darwin got the right answer, end of story. We expect it to change. We expect it to grow. But I think this is the key conclusion for us. If Darwin's theory turns out to fail, we should look for another natural scientific explanation. In other words, don't do the God of the gap. Darwin has showed us that a natural origin of species is credible, is scientifically plausible. I'm sure he hasn't got the whole of the right answer. But where he is shown to be inadequate, we should look for another scientific explanation, not just throw our hands up in horror and say, oh, well, Darwin got it wrong, back to God. Okay, just before we move on from evolution, let's look at the theological status. And I'm here going to be arguing from what the Catholic Church says because that's my own particular expertise. And if other people in the question time want to chip in other theological points of view, I'll be very happy with that. Initially, the Catholic Church didn't instantly respond, but certain prominent people, like John Henry Newman, was quite happy with Darwin's theory of evolution. So it wasn't sort of immediately, oh gosh, that's got to be against what the Catholic Church teaches, what Christianity teaches. Around about the turn of the 20th century, the Pontifical Biblical Commission responded to not just to the question of evolution, but more to the question of how do we interpret the scriptures, particularly the beginning of Genesis generally. It was a time of enormous caution in the church, a time that was known as the modernist crisis. But even then, it allowed that the beginning of Genesis didn't always have to be interpreted literally. So, for instance, the 6 days of creation didn't have to be interpreted as literally 6 periods of 24 hours. That could be interpreted figuratively. In 1950, Pope Pius XII published a document called Humani Generis, which did look at the question of evolution head-on and said this: the teaching of the Church does not forbid that the doctrine of evolutionism, insofar as it inquires into the origin of the human body from already existing living matter, be, according to the present state of human disciplines and sacred theology, treated in research and discussion by experts on both sides. As to the souls, the Catholic faith demands us to hold that they are immediately created by God. So that establishes an important principle, that we're talking about the evolution of the human body and of bodies of other animals, but we're not talking about the evolution of souls. But Pius XII, in a significant teaching document, did say that evolution may be considered. Pope John Paul II, in 1996, addressing the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, said that in the intervening time since Humanae Generis, today, new knowledge has led to the recognition that the theory of evolution is more than a hypothesis. In other words, he was acknowledging that it has become accepted scientific theory. And we saw a couple of weeks ago, just to refresh our memories, that the Catechism of the Catholic Church, talking about things a little more generally, said the question about the origins of the world and of man has been the object of many scientific studies which have splendidly enriched our knowledge of the age and dimensions of the cosmos and the development of life forms and the appearance of man. These discoveries invite us to an even greater admiration for the greatness of the Creator. And again, another paragraph says, the human person created in the image of God is a being at once corporeal and spiritual. The biblical account expresses this reality in symbolic language. Saint Augustine contributes interestingly to this debate. It's a sort of slightly curious way to do it. What he was trying to do was work out how to reconcile what the first chapter of the book of Genesis says and what the second chapter of the book of Genesis says. Do you remember again 2 weeks ago we saw that in the 6 days of creation account, things occur in a different order from chapter two, the sort of Adam and Eve and making mankind from the dust of the earth account of creation. Augustine was grappling with that question, and what he suggested was this. That in Genesis 1, what God is creating is what he calls rational seeds. And in Genesis 2, what it's talking about is the way that those rational seeds develop under God's providence into the visible forms that we see now through the interaction with the environment. It's not a theory of evolution, but it's interestingly close, that what's created at the beginning is a sort of seed, and through the interaction with the environment that God has created, through his providence, it develops into the forms we now see. So whatever it is, about 1500, 1600, 1700 years before Charles Darwin came on the scene, Saint Augustine is putting forward a theory that looks quite like evolution. So if we're going to say that it doesn't disagree with the Bible, for example, it's not just that we're saying that because, oh dear, now we've discovered what Darwin said, we'd better reassess the situation. Well over 1,000 years before Darwin was even a twinkle in his mother's eye or father's eye, we were already considering those questions. Still, evolution is not the formal teaching of the Catholic Church. You do not have to believe in evolution to be a Christian. But if you don't, you should have good reasons why not. And in any case, we're not free just to say that modern science is a load of rubbish. That's not something we're free to say, because, as we saw again a couple of weeks ago, the God who created the natural world and gave us intelligence to do science is the same God who reveals himself in the scriptures and in Jesus Christ. And God doesn't contradict himself. So actually, we're speaking against his intelligence and his gifts to us if we reject modern science out of court. Enough about evolution. Let's come back to the key question today. Can we find evidence that there is a personal designer God? I think we probably can. We can all agree, I hope, that life is pretty amazing. It needs explaining. That's why we've got a theory of evolution, because we know that life needs explaining. And we've seen that the development of the Big Bang from, in, from its very early beginnings through to intelligent life is an extraordinary process of development that needs explaining. And the laws of science, in particular Darwinian evolution, neo-Darwinian evolution, can do a lot of the explaining. And we can expect future theories to do even more of the explaining at some level. But just before that means the atheists have a party, hang on a minute. Natural selection obviously depends on very specific biochemistry, DNA, proteins, and the like. Biochemistry requires very special, simpler chemistry, particularly the chemistry of carbon. Chemistry requires very specific laws of physics. And physics requires, well, what? If there's anything natural beneath the laws of physics, physicists are going to claim that as part of physics. Physics wants to study the very lowest level, the most basic way that the universe works. So if the laws of physics have to be specified for life, well, then what could possibly be lower than that? Maybe there we are getting back to something that begins to look like God. Because it has to be something lower than the most basic natural processes. Because the most basic natural processes are science, are physics. Let's have a look at some of the issues. What are called anthropic coincidences? It's been one of the dawning observations of the 20th and 21st centuries that if you just make any old universe with any old set of laws of physics, you don't often end up with a universe that can support life. In fact, the laws of physics that we've got seem to be very finely balanced or finely tuned to allow life to develop. They've been called anthropic principles or anthropic coincidences, but it would probably be better to call them cosmological life-supporting coincidences. Cosmological because they are ways that the whole universe is structured, not just particular parts of it. We're not just saying, oh, how wonderful the Earth is, for example, just the right distance from the sun, so that it's not too hot and not too cold and so forth, because there are loads and loads of other planets. And, you know, you might expect that there'll be some planets that are just the right distance from the star. But we're talking about how the whole universe is tuned for life. And anthropic suggests that it's specifically focused on human life, and at least that's not what the science has yet discovered, but it certainly has discovered important things that need to be well specified for life. Let's just have a look at a few examples. First of all, the fact that space is three-dimensional. If space is more than three-dimensional, you can do the maths and prove that you can't have any stable orbits around a star for a planet to go round. In four dimensions or more, any planet going around a star will have an unstable trajectory, and it'll just fly off into space or dive straight into the star or whatever else it will be. Its trajectory through space will be chaotic. It won't be able to form a nice stable orbit for billions of years, which is what you need for life to develop. The mass of the proton is almost exactly the same as the mass of the neutron. If protons were much heavier than neutrons, all protons in the world would decay into neutrons, and the only thing that you'd find would be neutron stars, which are not able to support life. If neutrons were much heavier than they are, all the neutrons in the universe would decay into protons, and the only chemical element you could have would be hydrogen. And that's not enough to get life going. You need carbon and oxygen and what have you. So the fact that those two are carefully matched matters. It also matters that it's the neutron that's slightly heavier than the proton. Because if it were the other way round, if the proton was slightly heavier than the neutron, then individual protons would decay into neutrons, and you couldn't have ordinary hydrogen as a chemical element. It would just decay. And after carbon, hydrogen's probably the most important element in supporting life, along with oxygen. There are various forces that exist in the insides of atoms and so forth. One of them's called, rather prosaically, the strong force. If that were 10% weaker, this is the force that holds protons and neutrons together in the nucleus of an atom. If that were 10% weaker, all atoms with more than just one particle in the middle would fall to pieces. Again, you'd only have hydrogen. No carbon, no life. If it were 4% stronger, then all the stars in the universe would burn up so much faster that there wouldn't be time enough for life to evolve on a planet around a star before it burnt up. The strong force has to be very carefully balanced with the force of electromagnetism to within about 1% to allow the nuclear reactions in stars to produce carbon. Otherwise, they would almost certainly just stop at going from hydrogen to helium, and that would be as far as it gets. There's just a particular balance of energy, which is called a resonance, that allows three helium nuclei to fuse into carbon. This was discovered by a guy called Fred Hoyle, who's another person who's no particular friend of God. And when he discovered it, he said, the universe is a put-up job. You know, it just seems so coincidental. How can the universe have been so lucky? You may remember last time in the question, somebody talked about dark energy, dark matter, and then I was sort of going on about dark energy. That mysterious force that seems to be causing the universe to expand, and we don't really know what it is. But various theoretical suggestions about it suggest that it ought to be, naturally speaking, enormous. But actually, positive and negative contributions seem to cancel out so that it's only very, very weak. If it were much stronger, if it were only 10 times stronger, the whole universe would be expanding so enormously fast that you'd never get any decent-sized structures developing, no galaxies, no stars, no you and me. And in fact, the balance turns out to be one part in... that much. 10 to the power of 119. Or, if you want to put it another way, 10 billion billion Google. That's pretty impressive. So, theoretical physicist Paul Davies says this: a careful study suggests that the laws of the universe are remarkably felicitous for the emergence of richness and variety. In the case of living organisms, their existence seems to depend on a number of fortuitous coincidences that some scientists and philosophers have hailed as nothing short of astonishing. Fair enough. So unless we're extraordinarily dull, then the life-friendliness of the universe needs to be explained. Just to say that it's an unimaginably lucky fluke seems to be giving up on science. And even Richard Dawkins and his gang admit that there's something to be explained here. That's why they're in their books, when they're trying to get you to be atheists, they admit they need to try and explain this, and they do. And it seems to me, and it seems to them, that there are really only two plausible explanations. There are a few more implausible ones that we'll touch on in a minute, but there are two plausible ones. One is a designer god, and the other one is what's called a multiverse. The idea that this universe might not be the only one there is. There might be lots and lots and lots of other universes, perhaps infinitely many universes. We've got to think about that theory then. If there are vast numbers of universes, billions, trillions, maybe infinitely many universes, and they're all just a little bit different from one another, then hopefully, surely, some of them, one or two of them, will be right for life just by chance. The theory sounds quite far-fetched. There's no direct evidence for other universes. There can't be any direct evidence for other universes, because by definition, if we're in this universe, another universe is somewhere we can't see or do experiments on. So we can't have any direct evidence. But we can have indirect evidence. And actually, the way that modern cosmology is going is suggesting that the idea that there could be other universes, other Big Bangs, is looking more and more plausible. And it sort of goes roughly like this. Okay, this is my rather feeble attempt to try and show the whole multiverse expanding enormously quickly, much faster than our universe is expanding. But within this vast, exponentially expanding space, little bubbles appear that are expanding more slowly. And that the Big Bang that gives rise to the universe that we're in would just be one of those smaller bubbles, if you like, within the much more fast expanding space around it. I can't really go into the physics of why that's plausible, A, because I haven't got time, and B, because I'm not clever enough. But those people who are clever enough do suggest that this is plausible. Also, what they suggest is that the particular laws of physics that will emerge in these different bubble universes are likely to be different, so that the laws that we find here are, as it were, local bylaws. And if you go to the next door Big Bang, you're likely to find a different set of laws, a different set of bylaws. And you go to another one, and there'll be another set of bylaws there as well. There will be some deep down underlying law of physics that unites all of these and will be the same everywhere. But it's not just the laws that we've discovered so far. The laws and properties of the universe we've discovered so far turn out then just to be local conditions, local bylaws. However, I put it to you that if we've got a scientifically plausible, a scientifically explained multiverse, then we've actually got nowhere in trying to explain why the universe is life-friendly. And the argument goes something like this, that this theory can explain why some universes, some localities in that greater whole are favourable for life, because those different bylaws are different in all those Big Bangs that have gone off. And if there are enough of them, and they're all slightly different, some of them are going to be lucky enough to be able to support life. But what it doesn't explain is why the multiverse as a whole supports life. What we were saying a minute ago is if you just make a random system with random laws, it's unlikely to support life. Well, that doesn't matter whether it's an individual Big Bang or whether it's a multiverse. And if you just make a random multiverse with some random deep down underlying law, there's no reason to suppose that will just magically support life in any of its parts. You still need to have a carefully specified deep down underlying law of the whole multiverse to be life supporting, life specific. What that means really is this, that when we talk about the multiverse, we're not really talking about many universes, we're talking about many Big Bangs in one bigger universe. And what we call the multiverse is the real universe, and what we used to call the universe is only a part of it. Actually, that whole process of realizing, ooh, the universe is bigger than we used to think, has been going on since since Copernicus was a lad. You know, we used to think that the Earth was pretty much all there was, and there are a few bits and pieces like the sun and the moon going around it. And then we realized, oh, hang on, no, it's bigger than that. The sun's at the middle, and the Earth's just a little bit of rock going around it. And then we realised, hang on, that whole solar system's only a tiny part of our galaxy. And then we realised, hang on, the galaxy is only a tiny part of what came out of the Big Bang. Well, all we've done now then is to say, oh, hang on, the Big Bang's only a tiny part of what we now call the multiverse. Well, that doesn't freak us out scientifically or philosophically anymore. We've been doing that and dealing with that for centuries. The universe is just bigger. Brilliant. Hallelujah. Praise God. That's it. So we've just got one real universe scientifically explained, and whatever its underlying law is, you can't just pluck one out of thin air and hope it's going to make life. That needs to be specifically chosen. So any scientifically plausible multiverse, I don't think, gets us out of the need for a designer God, a need for a principle, the cause of the ultimate universe, to specify the right law to make the universe life-friendly. So maybe we need to move on from the scientifically plausible multiverses to other ways of thinking about why the universe might be life-friendly. Just to touch on some of these briefly. Some people have suggested that maybe there is only one mathematically possible underlying law for the whole universe. And it just turns out to be lucky that whatever that one mathematically coherent equation is, happens to support life. That seems to be an extraordinarily unlikely theory, given what we've just been saying a minute ago about those anthropic coincidences, that you can easily conceive of lots of sorts of universes that don't support life. So that doesn't seem to work. Another idea put forward by a physicist called John Wheeler is that the universe has to be observed in order to exist. You can't exist unless you're observed. That sort of follows in weird ways from quantum mechanics that I haven't got time to come on to. But even if that's true, that doesn't explain why the universe has to exist or be observed in the first place. If a universe has to be observed in order to exist, why doesn't it just not exist? You haven't explained why it's life-friendly. You've only said that it's got to be if it's here. But why does it have to be here at all? This guy, Max Tegmark, happy-looking guy, comes up with another peculiar theory. He suggests that the laws of physics are the universe. So rather than saying that the mathematical equations and laws that we think of as describing the universe are just descriptions, he thinks the mathematics really is the universe. Just like the number two exists, or the equilateral triangle exists, so whatever the equation is that describes our universe, it exists mathematically, and that's all this universe is. It's just a mathematical reality. But because every mathematical reality exists in sort of the mathematical conceptual world, if the universe is only mathematics, then every possible universe must exist, including this one, with life in it. Got to think that one through carefully. But I think that's confused thinking. It's confused thinking at its starting point to suggest that this world we live in is just mathematics. No, the whole point is there is mathematics that describes it, but the mathematics is a description and the world is the thing that it describes, and it's a different thing. If the world is just mathematics, mathematics never changes. So if the world is just mathematics, there's no real causality or change or flow of time or free will. Those are all illusions, which then seems to make human life rather pointless and even makes Max Tegmark's life rather pointless, as he rather admits at the end of his book, and then says, sort of, la, 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 we'll never mind about that, let's carry on as if it's okay, which I think really is all we need to know. And so the bottom line is, well, maybe they're just are lots and lots of universes that are different for no good reason at all. Well, since where we came in at the beginning of last week was we agree that universes do need to be caused, the idea that there are just heaps and heaps and heaps of them for no good reason seems to be shallow. And what's more, it's basically giving up on science. And that's sort of my point. That if you don't give up on science, you agree that the universe needs explaining. And you agree that life needs explaining. And it's meaningful. That's why we need to explain it. So let's come on to conclusions. I think the only thing left as a rational conclusion to what we've seen is that there is a personal designer God. That's my conclusion. I'm not trying to ram that down your throat, but if you don't agree with me, I'd be fascinated to hear your alternative. Genuinely. The first cause of the universe that we discovered last week, I think, has to be a designer. Something that chooses the ultimate law of the universe or multiverse for life. It's not a God of the gaps argument. It's not saying science can't explain the universe, therefore we invoke God. It's saying that science can explain the universe, therefore we need God. It doesn't explain where God comes from or how God designs the universe, but we don't expect to explain that. That's what we mean by the word God. So, we can see that the universe is contingent. It needs to be caused, and therefore there must be a first cause. Something which doesn't need to be caused, something which does just exist, and is therefore unlike the things that we see in the universe, and unlike the universe, something non-material, something a bit like God. And similarly, we've seen from the life specificity of the universe that life needs explaining. Life is significant and valuable. Therefore, there must be a designer that chose that, chose life. Something that doesn't need to be designed, which is just intelligent. Not a complex mechanism, not a supercomputer, but in some way personal. A bit like God, a first designer. To be sure, that idea is mysterious. But the whole point of science is to explain the universe, and it works. So the cosmos needs an explanation, and to deny that is to deny science. There are mysteries left, and the task of the intelligent person, I suggest, is to explain the explainable, to recognize the mystery of the unexplainable, and not to mix these two up. The universe, or the multiverse, is explainable. That's what science is all about. So the mystery must be something else, completely different from the universe, non-material, something that can't be studied in science, something like God. Thank you very much.